Welcome to the Global from Asia podcast, where the daunting process of running an international business from Hong Kong is broken down into straight up actionable advice. And now, your host, Michael Michelini.
Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to episode 15 of Global from Asia. Happy 2014. It's our first episode in the new year, and I hope everybody's already having a great 2014. Thanks for tuning in. So today is our second part of a two-part series with John Buford. Last week, he was talking about the Hong Kong startup scene and his business, Makeable, how it got traction and then funding. So definitely listen to that. So this week, we're going to talk about three different ways a company can get funding at the seed stage, and also some interesting insights and differences of getting funding in Asia or Hong Kong versus America or Silicon Valley. So hope you guys enjoy it. Three different ways a company can get funding at the seed stage.
So the first ones were direct money for a particular percentage of the company, so to speak, in the existing share table. And then the next round were, so that structure is straightforward. The one thing that I would say, when you set up the company, one thing that a lot of people don't realize that they need to do here is you really do want a shareholders agreement, because that outlines a lot of the nitty-gritty as the rights of the shareholders and things like that. And a lot of people just don't realize that they need one. I didn't. So, a year or two later, as you kind of move up the ladder in terms of investors that have more intelligence and more experience, potentially will come back to bite you if you don't have a shareholders agreement in place. Yeah, so straight equity deal. In terms of you put money into the company and then you get X percentage or X number of shares, that's pretty straightforward. For that, a lot of times the kind of the things that are questions are, okay, board seat, who has control? If you're taking on $10,000 in funding, how much of the company are they giving, getting back in return? If they're doing, let's say for an early stage company, if they're doing $25,000 US, if they're getting more than 10 to 20% of the company, something probably kind of wonky. You might want to go back and do some work before you do the deal, because if you can't justify that your company's worth at least, say, roughly $1 million for that round, then you're probably taking on funding too early. That would be one way of looking at it. As far as a lot of times at that point, investors will rightly ask for you to have vesting on shares. And especially if you have more than one co-founder, everybody should be vesting the shares, which means, so let's say that you have four people and you divide the company up evenly between four people, which probably a recipe for disaster if everybody has the same number of shares in some ways, especially if you have exactly two co-founders and you divide it up 50-50, very likely that over the life of the company, somebody's going to wind up dropping out. It's not guaranteed to happen, but statistically it happens a lot. And so if both of you have the shares already fully issued to you from the beginning, and then one drops out or life happens. And that's generally usually why things go wrong. If you both have it fully issued instead of vesting over, say, 3 or 4 years, if that person drops out, there's legally nothing that the other person can do. And especially if it's 50-50, you legally can't even do things for the company a lot of times if you haven't set it up correctly. So early stage, taking on investment, be careful how much you give away, because if you wind up not owning enough of the company, you don't have motivation to grow it. You can kind of tell an early stage investor if they try to get controlling interest in the company. So if they try to set it up so that through the most probable way of growth, so if let's say that they set you up and they say, okay, I'm taking half the company and then we'll vest you into the other half or something, they're probably setting you up to fail, because they're not aligning your motivation and incentives with what you need to accomplish. And I would tend to stay away from people that are too aggressive in trying to have ownership of that company. It should be the founder that really is driving the company, unless you both agree that you're not suitable for growing the company, that you're more suitable as being a early employee, so to speak. So that's an equity deal. Convertible note. So the concept behind a convertible note, it's kind of a convenient way of using a document that was actually, it's a loan document. So it's literally the potential investor is, and within the note structure, you're actually paying money as a loan that's payable back in a certain time period. And there's usually, typically there's going to be some sort of interest. I think legally you tend to have to put this into a loan document in most places. And then there'll be a defined period, and then there'll be usually some clauses within it for, and this is where it basically has gotten turned around and used as an equity finance vehicle. So basically there'll be clauses in the loan note that stipulate if, let's say, you get X amount of funding for an equity deal, like the one that I talked about previously. So let's say that you do a convertible note round for $100,000 US. And then in the convertible note, you stipulate if you do a equity deal for $500,000 or $1 million US, it'll automatically convert at the valuation, or possibly you'll get a discount, which means, so let's say the value of the equity deal for the company, so you start out at $1 million. Let's say that your Series A that triggers the conversion for the convertible note is $10 million, just for nice round numbers. If the convertible note, there's two key points on the convertible note. There's a discount rate, and then there's a cap. You don't have to have a cap, but most investors will require it. And it generally, uncapped convertible notes are a bit dodgy unless you know for a fact that you're going to, if there's a conversion event coming up very soon. So if you have a discount, let's say that the discount is, so typical discounts are between 10 to 25%. That's the normal range. If it's more than that or less than that, something's probably kind of weird about it. So let's say that you have, just for easy numbers, let's say you have a 10% discount on your convertible note. And then let's say that you have a $5 million cap on that convertible note. So what's going to happen, as long as the value of the equity deal is less than about $5.5 million, they're going to convert at the value of the equity deal minus 10%. So let's say that the deal was at $5 million, they would still get a discount on that $5 million value. So it would be 10% less than five, so $4.5 million. Right. And yep. So the conversion rate would be at the value as if the company was valued at $4.5 million based on investing the money that they put in for the convertible note plus the interest that they had accrued over the time from when you signed the note to when the deal was done. Yeah. And then, so basically, convertible notes are good in the sense that they simplify the paperwork for doing the deal. They're very quick. You don't need to go through issuing shares and, updating the cap table and all that stuff. But the big downside of a convertible note, it is debt. So it on the book, and the thing is, early stage founders, a lot of times, unless you're from a finance background, a lot of founders will not look, they won't really understand the impact of any of these investment vehicles in terms of how it affects the operation of the company. So the one downside of a convertible note, it shows up on your books is that it's just like a loan from a bank or anything. And so if you want to if you want to have access to credit facilities, say from a bank, they're going to consider those notes as being debts that are outstanding that you would have to repay as part of your obligations. And so you're not as likely to be able to get as much cheap credit facility from banks if you have a lot of convertible notes sitting around, because they're going to look at that as effectively being loans on your books, even though in your head, you think of those as being equity deals. It's actually debt deals. And so convertible notes are probably not, and there's actually, Y Combinator this week just announced that they're switching over their standard document from being a convertible note to what's called convertible equity or convertible security. And I'll get into that next. So basically, convertible notes, they're convenient, but tend to avoid them if you can, because they complicate getting other types of financing in place for the company in a longer term. So we did convertible notes. Now we're doing convertible security deals. And the difference between a convertible note and a convertible security or convertible equity, depending on how you want to talk about it, basically it aligns everybody's interests a lot better than a convertible note. It's designed for the purpose that it's being used for. So the intent, somebody coming in and doing a convertible debt note or a convertible security note in the context of a startup, is you're intending for the person putting the money in to actually wind up with equity. The intent isn't to loan us money and then get it back as just as a interest loan. Yeah, it doesn't make sense. So basically, with a convertible security deal,
Yeah, if you want to explain, I mean, this is amazing.
Yeah. So with a convertible security deal, what you're doing is you're taking out the debt aspect of the deal. So all that a convertible security note does is it says, I'm putting in X amount of money, and the terms are very similar. I'm putting in X amount of money. For that, I expect if there is a conversion event that establishes the value of the company, then I'm going to convert at some discount rate. And that discount rate is the same thing as a convertible note, between 10 to 25%. And then with convertible security notes, many times you do not put an expiration date on it. You don't put an automatic conversion, period of a year or 2 years like you do with convertible notes. You actually, most of the time, they're open-ended to where, 3 years down the road, if a company finally does an equity deal that matches up with the conversion trigger, that's what will convert, and it's fine. So basically, the convertible security deal, all that it says is, I'm giving you money, and then it's going to convert into shares of the company at some point in the future. Like, there's no, and you pay it back in cash or anything like that. The only way that you complete the convertible security deal, the investor winds up with equity in their hands. And because there is no debt aspect to it, banks will not see it as being a debt. And so you can actually, you can raise funds using a convertible security note and then immediately be able to turn around to a bank and say, look, we've got $500,000 US in our account. We would like to have financing that leverages off of that amount. And the banks will be like, yes, you do have $500,000 in your account. Great. Let's give you a loan. And so it's a lot better. It actually, from an investor standpoint, it's a lot better because it means that your money that you're putting in, that company can use it in order to leverage it much more effectively. It doesn't just go straight into paying, for overhead or whatever. They can use it to get a multiplier on it in order to do more things with it to refine it. And so, let's say that you get $500,000 convertible security note, and you turn around to a bank and you get, let's say, $1 million in funding or finance, like basically lines of credit that you can pull from that, because you're securing it effectively between the business and then the cash that you receive from the convertible security deal. And so, especially if you have a lot of assets that you're buying, it'll help, because otherwise you're going to be putting that cash directly into assets instead of doing it through finance at a low interest rate, which is in your better interest, because then you don't have to go out and raise more funds as quickly. So convertible security is definitely a much better way of going. And I think if you look around in general, the people that are very much at the forefront of investment or early stage startups, I think you're going to see that convertible securities is what everybody's going to be doing in the near future. And then, so that pretty much covers that, kind of the three different main ways early stage startup investment would go.
Great. Thank you so much, John. Really, really valuable information. I guess another question I hear a lot, and I also have, is, I think you're obviously a Hong Kong structured company, and you're talking about Y Combinator, which is, primarily U.S.-based companies. Is there any difference in these deals or structures that you know of between a Hong Kong company and a U.S. company?
Well, not so much, I would say. It really depends on where the money's coming from, I think. And also, the other thing is actually how the ownership of the company is structured, because, citizens of different countries will have different obligations. Yeah. And so, that's the thing. So with a company structured in the U.S., if it's with U.S. citizens, then it's very clear. If it's a company outside of the U.S., but then if there's, say, U.S. citizens involved, then there's obligations that sometimes become very difficult because of regulations. So I think it's not really that different, but at the same time, I think doing any kind of international business becomes very, very tricky, because you have to, it's not just, are you okay within your jurisdiction? It's a matter of, making sure that you're not forgetting some sort of obligation, some random country that you have a tenuous connection to. Now, as far as the deals and things like that, from what we've seen, probably if you raise funds in Asia currently, probably going to get lower valuations than in the U.S. But at the same time, it's debatable as if it really makes any significant difference in the longer term. Because if you raise funds in the U.S., most of the time they're going to ask you to basically focus your business within the U.S. market. So a lot of U.S. investors, from what I understand, is that basically, yeah, they understand the U.S. market, and then they want to try to guide their companies that they invest in order to, you know, focus on that market because that's what they understand. But the strength of being outside of any one big market like the U.S. or Europe or, you know, even Japan, is a good example, is that you can pick and choose your markets. You can take advantage of markets that people that are located within those markets would never even, you know, consider exist. And if you look at Indonesia and Malaysia, and you're talking about population that is actually reasonably close to the U.S. in terms of population. But if you talk to a U.S.-based company, they won't even have a clue. They'll be like, Indonesia and Malaysia, that's like an island somewhere in the Pacific, right? Yeah, and yeah. Like they'll be envisioning like this, you know, like sandy beach with like 10 people, you know, sitting around in grass huts or something. They're not going to, you know, picture, you know, these very established countries that have real markets, that have their own type of spending power. And so that's the thing is, I think a lot of companies that are taking money and are focusing on effectively developed markets, they're missing a lot of opportunities.
Got it. Yeah, I also agree. I mean, I kind of admit as an American myself, when I first came to Asia, I was not expecting to be as developed as I thought. And I think still a lot of American perception is that it's not developed, or it's like dirt roads and like grass, or, you know, brick, like mud huts or something. So I also agree with you there. I think we're wrapping up. This has been a much longer episode than expected, but it's definitely very valuable. We always kind of, yeah, it's going to be a great episode. I'm really excited. But I mean, a tip for maybe an early stage tech startup in Hong Kong or coming to Hong Kong or in Asia, what would you kind of, you probably talked to a lot of them already, but what's your maybe common advice for them to get started or, you know, get going?
Yeah, well, so there's a few different things. One, it's easy enough to reach out to people within the startup community here, even if you're abroad. So for the most part, if people have time, they will at least attempt to, you know, try to clue people in from overseas if somebody expressed interest. One government-connected body called InvestHK, and they have a mandate in order to help companies come and set up in Hong Kong. So they actually, even for small startups, you know, one-person startups, whatever, that's their whole role is to help make that transition easy. And they're becoming much more startup aware and friendly, I would say. Now, yeah, so once you get here, there's kind of two different things that people tend to do. One, people just kind of pop over here and kind of do a scouting mission, so to speak, to try to determine if it's a good fit. Some people, I think, literally, they just hop on a plane with, you know, all their worldly possessions that they want to bring in, and they just go ahead and take the plunge before doing any prearrangements. So I think both work, but like either way, Hong Kong especially is quite accessible. If you come here, so reaching out to people before you get here, yeah, you'll get some people that will follow up with you. If you're here though, stupidly easy to connect with people, and what you'll find is once you connect with one or two people, they'll connect you with and other people until you find the right fit or mentors or partners or whatever it is. So networking in Hong Kong is kind of unreal, but it's also, like, because of the density. So, like, yesterday I was at a meeting at a coffee shop where I saw a handful of other people that I knew, and then I made an introduction from those guys to the guy I was meeting with. So then he immediately had, in a broader network, just within a 1 or 2 hour period. That's pretty common here. As far as investment visas go, as long as you have a reasonable amount of cash that you can show, the Hong Kong government's pretty good about granting at least the first year investment visa. After the first year, you do have to show that you're hiring local things. But before that, yeah, it's as long as you are not going to be on the street, you know, begging, as long as you can make the case that you're not going to be a liability in that kind of sense, payments. They're pretty flexible in terms of, as long as you've got a reasonable, just a plan with enough resources, it's pretty straightforward, I would say. Everything else, like setting up a company here, you know, like getting a flat, whatever, it's definitely not like, say, mainland China, where you know, there's not that many hoops to go through. You can start a company with overseas passport. You can rent a flat with an overseas passport. You don't need a local ID in order to kind of get things rolling. You can do it as a foreign person. So it's actually very straightforward here in that sense.
Great. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's definitely, I think it's also maybe a British influence that's helped it make it very transparent. And okay, so thanks so much, John. And then for contacting you or reaching out, probably Twitter, or how do you want people to maybe follow up if there's any?
Twitter's probably the easiest. You can also through our website, the customer support at Makeable. So it's customer_support@makeable.com. Other than that, yeah, I'm kind of generally around various social media channels, but probably Twitter or directly through that email is easiest.
So thanks so much. It's a wrap. All right. Thank you, John, for that interview. Really appreciate it again. Well, I think we'll definitely have to get John back on the show maybe in 6 months, give us an update about his developments. Okay. And now some words from our listeners. This is a special feedback for me. It was Damien Ruse. He's a friend of mine, also a member at Dynamite Circle. I met him a few years ago in the Philippines at a Tropical MBA meetup. And he actually pushed me over the edge a little bit with this podcast by helping getting the artwork set up. The artwork you might be looking at today, listening to this on your iPhone or your Android, is made by him. So I really appreciate that, Damien, and also your precious feedback always. So he sent me an email. It's a private email, and I don't mind sharing some constructive feedback. And let me read it out loud. I caught a few episodes, but anything startups is not of interest or relevant to me. I love to get a bit more nitty-gritty, expense claiming, yearly audits, etc. I had trouble in the Hong Kong PayPal, could be a good topic, pitfalls, problems, etc. with Hong Kong PayPal, as well as specific merchant account info. All right, thanks, Damien. Yes, I'm going to continue to improve, and maybe I'll have different types of series where there's some for maybe startups or some for normal business entrepreneurs, small businesses. And actually, next episode 16 is going to be Joe Chan from AsiaPay, which is a Hong Kong-based merchant account. And we were lucky enough to get him on the show, and that'll be in next week's episode. So definitely tune into that one. And appreciate everybody's feedback, and constructive, positive, even negative. I'm listening. So thanks again. And have a great day, guys.
To get more info about running an international business via Hong Kong, please visit our website at www.globalfromasia.com. That's www.globalfromasia.com. Also, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes feed. Thanks for tuning in.